Fido.
We're go fly.
Guidance.
Guidance go.
Procedures.
Go.
Capcom.
We're go fly.
Launch control, this is Houston. We are go for launch.
This is Space Talk, a weekly program that highlights America's space program and what's new in the space flight from around the globe. And now, with the past, present, and future of space exploration, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, good afternoon, everybody, to all of you along Florida's Space Coast and around the nation of the world, listening in online at WMMBAM.com. I am Jim Behnke, and you're listening now to the October 17th, 2009 edition of Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance, innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. Well, the cold front moved through Florida last night, and it is a lot cooler out today. Let's see here. The number, the machine in front of me says it's 75 degrees outside right now along Florida's Space Coast. It's cool. It's fall is here. Not quite Minnesota, where I'm from, Minneapolis right now, logging in at 45 degrees. So I guess we still have the place to be, but it sure does feel good to have fall arrive. It puts everyone in a great mood. Especially for tonight, the National Space Club Florida Committee sponsoring the annual Space Ball at the Doubletree Hotel in Cocoa Beach. If you are out and about tonight and happen to see a lot of people dressed in fancy clothes, cocktail dresses, even a few tuxedos around Cocoa Beach, they're probably some of your space program folks gathering together for our annual just a nice big family gathering, I guess, of social dining and dancing and hanging out together. No program, no speeches, just a lot of fun with our family and friends. So the great thing about our Space Ball is that it helps raise money for the Brevard Space Week program that we're a part of, the National Space Club Florida Committee is a part of, which helps send sixth graders. Every sixth grader in Brevard County schools gets to go to the Kennedy Space Center Visitor Complex for a day. And that's happening here starting in late November and into early December as we work all those kids through the Visitor Complex. We'll talk more about that as we get closer. But a great event in the space community tonight. And I know some of you listening will see you there later tonight. Well, look, what's going on in space this week? A few things have happened, and I want to fill you in on some neat things. First of all, did you know that last night at about 11:44 p.m. Eastern time, an asteroid swept by Earth? It was about 30 feet across and moved to within about 216,000 miles of Earth. That's a little bit closer than what the where the moon is at a quarter million miles away. And it was only discovered just a few days ago, and it's just one of those smaller objects, estimated to be about 7 million such objects around Earth, near-Earth objects they're called. And this one was discovered very late, called 2009 TM8, and went by. No harm, no foul, nothing happening. But once again, another reminder that space is not as empty as you might think it is. And in fact, we're going to talk more about that with a guest here coming up on Halloween of all days, October 31st. Former NASA astronaut Tom Jones will be joining us. And among the many things we'll be talking about is his desire to see us explore some of these asteroids and near-Earth objects so that should one ever have a bullseye on Earth, we can maybe perhaps take care of it in some way, but we need to learn more about these objects before we can do that. A little closer to home, a little more in our own backyard, the Ares 1X rocket rollout from the Vehicle Assembly Building to Pad 39B at the Kennedy Space Center. Last time we talked last week with our Ares 1X preview with John Cowart, the rocket was scheduled to roll out early Monday morning. That had been delayed to Tuesday morning now as the week progressed. Due to a problem they found in the hydraulic system at the base of the rocket. And in fact, the possibility that this rocket rollout may not happen until Wednesday morning is still a possibility. We haven't heard anything new yet today as to how tests of the replacement of a faulty seal went and whether or not they think they are on schedule to move out Tuesday morning. The concern that they're looking at right now is that depending on if they delayed to Wednesday morning, could they still make a launch date of October 27th, which is the plan? And that's such an important date, an important launch for the Kennedy Space Center. A lot of eyes are on that right now. And we should know more in a few days here, perhaps even as early as Monday, hopefully. Also rolling out, making it to the pad this past week, Atlantis was rolled out to the launch pad, Pad 39A. It went out earlier this week. They are now targeted for launch November 12th. That's looking pretty good. And, in fact, November is really lining up to be quite a busy month of launches. In fact, if you count, if everything got off the ground the way it's set out right now, starting with the Ares 1X launch on October 27th, during the next calendar month or so, the next four and a half, five weeks, we could see, one, two, three, four, five launches from the Cape, all of major big rockets. You're starting off with the Ares 1X on the 27th of October, Space Shuttle Atlantis going to the International Space Station on November 12th. An Atlas V rocket is targeted to launch on November 14th. That will be followed, hopefully, by a Delta IV rocket on November 18th. And the all-important SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket, another brand-new rocket debuting here on the Space Coast. And this one is its own huge story all by itself, which we'll certainly address as we get closer, is now targeted for launch November 29th. And hopefully they'll still be able to make that day. But at least that's what's on the range right now. We'll see if everyone can accommodate that and make it happen as we get a little bit closer to all these dates. So it could be pretty spectacular month. And I'll tell you, a couple of those launches are at night too. So again, with the fall air and beautiful night to be out, great time to have some of these launches in nice, cool, crisp air. That should be pretty spectacular. Let's see. That's looking forward. Let's look back a little bit. A couple of things happened to kind of be nostalgic over the past week here. Let's see. Today, I guess it is, if we're going to call it Nostalgia Saturday, we learned and actually came out, I guess the news came out a couple of days ago, that TDRS-1, the Tracking and Data Relay Satellite, the very first one that was ever launched aboard Space Shuttle Challenger in 1983 on Challenger's first flight on mission STS-6. This communications satellite that went up for NASA was finally retired. Its final communications equipment failed. They can still control the satellite and communicate it that way, but the communication services that the satellite provided no longer work, and they've retired that satellite. And they're going to soon bump it up into a higher orbit to clear it from being any kind of an orbital debris problem. But TDRS-1, TDRS is the acronym again, Tracking and Data Relay Satellite. Several of these have been launched by the Space Shuttle and by unmanned rockets over the years. And this is the network of satellites that allow NASA, and a lot of other folks too, by the way, to maintain constant communication, at least in the case of NASA and the Space Shuttle and the Space Station, a nearly constant communication stream between the vehicle in space and the mission control on the ground. Before this satellite came on board, before this constellation of satellites were put up, only when a manned ship, an Apollo capsule, Mercury, Gemini, or even the early shuttles, flew over a ground station could mission control talk to the vehicle. So there'd be times when you go hours without talking to the crew in space. And, you know, there's some good side and bad side to it. You want to maintain communications with your spacecraft. On the other hand, I've heard a few astronauts say over the years they didn't mind it when it was quiet from mission control. So it kind of went back and forth. And these series of satellites have just totally revolutionized the way we do space flight and controlling space flights, monitoring things. These satellites have used tracking launches. They're used by Hubble to send communications down to Earth, the other satellites to relay information back and forth. And so a very important constellation of satellites have been a very historical part of our space program. And again, the news there that the first one of these, TDRS-1, launched on Challenger in 1983, now officially retired. So that's a little bit look back at something that's been going on. I guess what we want to do here is we're going to get ready to take a break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the future of the space program and all parts of it as we're joined by the president of the Space Foundation, again, right after we take this quick break. Give us a call, 321-768-1240, and send your email to spacetalking@AOL.com. I'm Jim Behnke. This is Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance.
Now, back to our own mission specialist, Jim Behnke.
Well, that's right. Welcome back, everybody, to Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. Once again, your calls are welcome here, 321-768-1240, anywhere along the Space Coast. As an AT&T wireless customer, you can dial *1240 and get a free call right here into the studio. Or also send us email to spacetalking@AOL.com. We keep an eye on the AOL mail screen here and bring your questions and comments there. So anywhere you want to get a hold of us, we're standing by for your questions and comments, and you're certainly welcome to call in today. We're talking about all things space, so no question too silly today, that's for sure. Well, let me tell you, the world's largest gathering of space professionals happens every April in Colorado Springs in the form of the National Space Symposium, and I'm talking thousands of folks flocking to the Broadmoor Resort at the foot of the Rockies for what is really a first-class five-star Space Week experience that you just have to see to believe. Every topic of the space program, military, commercial, civilian, science, education, it's all discussed by the world's leading experts on all this. And that event each year is put on by the Space Foundation. And the man who leads that team is a longtime space professional, Elliot Pullum, who is on the line today with us from Colorado. Good afternoon, Elliot. How you doing?
Hey, good, Jim. Good to talk to you. And we'll send aloha and shout out to all our friends there on the Space Coast.
Well, that's great. Now, I'm going to just give a moment here, Elliot, a full disclosure just to make sure everybody understands that, in fact, I worked for 2 years for this man right here. I spent 2 years working for the Space Foundation. And I've got to tell you, if there's anyone on this or any other planet who might be a greater space cadet than I am, it's this native of Hawaii that I have on the air with me right now. We had some fun, didn't we?
We sure did, Jim, and we miss you, but we're still having fun. And I know our folks down in Florida see you from time to time, and hope to get down there soon for one of these last few shuttle launches so we can hook up and talk again.
Yeah, that'd be good. Now, I mentioned the NSS, the National Space Symposium, and I guess that's probably the most visible thing the Space Foundation does in the space community, but it's only the tip of the iceberg. Why don't you spend a moment, tell us what else the foundation does, and what are some of the programs that that you'd like to talk about?
Well, thanks, Jim. It's really kind of an interesting, you know, curse to have, the National Space Symposium is such a fantastic event, and everybody identifies the Space Foundation with that event. But we do so many other things all year round that we're really proud of. Our education programs are probably the thing I'm most proud of right at this moment, although we might want to talk about our international outreach and the trip to China I just came back from. Extremely pleased with the work we're doing internationally as well. As you know, we have a research operation, a think tank, if you will, in Washington, government affairs operation in Washington. And so we've got our fingers into just about everything to do with space, and if it's got to do with space, whether it's commercial, national security, whatever, we want to be there and we want to make it happen.
Well, before I talk, I'm going to ask you about strategic space in Omaha in a second, but I want you mentioned the think tank, and it reminded me about the space report, which was a brand new report. Now, are you in the third? Is it the third edition now yet? You're about to put out.
We are actually working now on the fourth edition.
The fourth one, okay.
And yeah, the third edition came out last year. And, it's a great piece of work, and it gets better every year.
This is a remarkable publication. I think everyone studying space, whether you're an engineer or a scientist or a policy person or commercial business education, this is a publication you need to pick up. Go to spacefoundation.org and check out how to get it, because it's got all the latest information about the world space programs and all the numbers behind it, especially the gee whiz statistics, the good numbers about finance, the good numbers about what's going up and coming down, and it's just it's a remarkable document. Now, Elliot, you and I could interview each other at any time in the year, and I picked this time because you're only a couple of weeks away now from your other big conference, the one in Omaha, Strategic Space. Talk a little bit about that and what that's all about.
Well, Strategic Space is coming up here in a couple of weeks in Omaha, Nebraska. It's an event we started 7 years ago when United States Space Command was folded in to Strategic Command. The Space Missions of Space Command ended up going out to Omaha to a newly created strategic command, and we felt like those missions needed some visibility, and the advent of this new organization really was cause for wanting people to understand what this organization was, what it was doing, how it was managing these new missions. And there's been so much going on and changing year to year out there at StratCom that it continues to be a really interesting event. You know, it's clearly not for everyone. It's strictly a military space event. It's very much focused on StratCom. StratCom is the warfighting command that has responsibility for space. And so Air Force Space Command, especially 14th Air Force out at JFCC Space in Vandenberg, these guys all get their taskings and have reporting relationships to Strategic Command, and so it's an important gathering. But as I say, it's not necessarily everybody's cup of tea because it is entirely a military event.
Well, and very focused on military as it should be, and I guess that's one of the things I wanted to talk about with you because. You know, folks, even here along the Space Coast, even here where we have the 45th Space Wing and the Air Force managing the Eastern Range, all of the publicity, all of the attention, you know, is usually focused on NASA and the space shuttle and the astronauts coming and going and all that that means. But in fact, our nation's military space program as a whole is actually a much bigger and, in fact, spends more money annually than NASA's budget. And I'm wondering if you could just take a moment and, you know, from a layman's perspective, from kind of a military space 101, give us a sense of how big the military space program is and talk a little bit more, very basically, about what it does for our nation.
Well, sure, Jim. And I'll use the opportunity to plug the space report again, since I'm going to use some numbers from the latest space report, and those people who are interested in that. Real simple URL, spacereport.org, if you'd like to download an executive summary for free, or if you wanted to actually go ahead and purchase a copy of the book. But we had, as an industry worldwide last year, almost $260 billion in revenue. It was 258.7 or something along those lines. And if you look at where the money is being spent, very interesting. Most people, as you say, you know, whether it's in Florida or elsewhere, they tend to watch the shuttle launches on TV, and you know, they pay attention when the shuttle launches or doesn't launch, and you know, largely perceive that that's the biggest part of the space program. In fact, the largest part of the space program is commercial. Commercial space companies and commercial space revenues count for about 70% of revenues worldwide. And if you look at the NASA point of that $258 or so billion dollars, NASA really represents only about 7 or 8%. It's really a quite small piece of what's going on overall. If you take NASA's budget, call it $18-19 billion a year, and then take a look at total U.S. spending, which is about $61 billion a year in government spending, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that we're spending 2 to 1 on military space programs as compared to civil space programs.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of a not fair comparison to make in some ways because, you know, one of the things that the Air Force does for us in military space is they operate the GPS constellation.
Right.
Develop new satellites, launch, replenish, maintain the constellation, make sure the signals are coming in. And that GPS signal is just the heart and soul of almost everything to do with commercial space. I mean, all those satellites that the commercial operators use, all the cell phone coverage, the multiple terrestrial and extraterrestrial networks, all rely on that GPS timing signal. And so the Air Force, even though their budget doesn't appear in the civil space column, really contributes a huge amount to that civil space revenue. Obviously, the Air Force also manages the nation's ranges. You know, you've got Cape Canaveral Air Force Station and Patrick Air Force Base down there. Everybody's familiar with the work that they do, the work that goes on out in Vandenberg. And again, if you looked at just Air Force Space Command and did a comparison with NASA, I think the last time I checked NASA employees was probably on the order of 14,000 or so.
Mm-hmm.
And Air Force Space Command 40,000, and I'm not sure how that may have changed in the last few months as the nuclear missions have been transferred out of Air Force Space Command to a new military command called Global Strike Command. But these guys do everything. I mean, they you know, keep the missiles alert. They watch the skies. They maintain the space catalog. They track the space debris. They maintain missile alert. They launch the EELVs for national security payloads. They run the Air Force labs for space. There's just so much going on in space in the military, and I've been saying Air Force, and I really need to jump in quickly and remind everybody that the Army and Navy as well are quite big in space, as are our allied military forces. And that's kind of the flavor you get at the strategic space event. We will have a lot of people from Europe, from Britain, from Australia.
Yeah. Ellie, let me jump in here really quick and just tell you that we're about to take our five-minute built-in hold at the bottom of the hour, and we're going to talk more about military space, civil space, and other things back at you in a little bit. This is Jim Behnke on Space Talk on WMMB.
It's an Endeavor roll program.
Roger, roll, Endeavor.
Now is the time for shuttle program employees to chart a new course.
OTCSGO.
A course that will take their careers beyond the last space shuttle mission to new job opportunities and horizons.
Fine, let's go.
Brevard Workforce is helping our community shuttle engineers, technicians, and administrative workers to launch new careers through the Aerospace Workforce Transition Program.
Houston, flight is go.
While they continue to safely launch the remaining shuttle missions. Through the programs, resources, and services, aerospace workers can map out a strategy. Undergo skill assessments, take workshops, update degrees and certifications, or receive education funding. Assistance is available and ready. Contact Brevard Workforce today and take the first easy step to prepare for a successful post-shuttle career in aerospace or other industries.
The launch team is ready to proceed.
Call Brevard Workforce at 394-0556. That's 394-0556. Visit them online at launchnewcareers.com or Twitter them at launchcareers.
You are go for launch.
With everything you need to know about America's space program, here is Jim Behnke.
Well, and welcome back again, everyone, to this second half of Space Talk on WMMB. I am Jim Behnke. The program today brought to you by United Space Alliance. Innovation you can trust, performance you can count on. From the folks at USA. Well, we certainly still invite you to give us a call with your questions. 768-1240 locally is the dial number. AT&T wireless customers, you can call us at *1240. 321 is the area code if you're from out of town, or if you care to send us an email, the address spacetalking@aol.com. We're continuing along with Elliot Pullum, the president of the Space Foundation in Colorado Springs. And, Elliot, we were talking about military space, and you know, I just tell you, I got a big kick out of the idea that, you know, GPS is such a pervasive part of our lives, and people don't realize it comes from the military. I get a kick out of hearing stories of people protesting this military thing or that military thing, and they use their GPS device in the car to get to the protest site. What do you think about that?
Well, you know, it's a great thing about our country, and that's one of the things that we got to thank our military for is keeping us free and making sure we've all got those rights to speak up, whether we're well-informed, ill-informed, or
that's right.
Have an agenda. At least we all have enjoy those privileges.
By the way, I should have asked you, it's 75 degrees here, and we think it's cool. Have you been on the ski slopes out there yet?
No, we have not, although we do have two resorts open with a couple of runs apiece. But actually here in the Springs today, I was listening to your weather report during the break, and
yeah.
Our weather here is just about like yours. We're going to be in the upper 70s today, down in the 50s tonight, and maybe into the 80s tomorrow. Of course, last week we were in the 20s, so
yeah.
You know, take that, it when you can get it.
You know, the 3 months I lived out there with you guys when we first started, it was surprised me more than anything else. I mean, you think the weather changes quickly here in Florida. You know, that's just a matter of it clears up in 10 minutes. You live out in Colorado Springs or Denver along the range there, man, your weather is different every day and radically different.
Highly unpredictable.
Something else. Well, look, let's move off military space and talk civilian space right now. You know, you're plugged into the industry, and you've been watching the Augustine panel, and you know as well as anyone about what's going on and what are the issues NASA's facing. You want to look into your crystal ball and tell us what might be happening here in the next week or so as this report is presented to the president and we see what the fallout might be?
Yeah, I think the important thing we all got to remember is not to get too excited here too soon, because there is a lot going on. In addition to this Augustine Commission report, there are two national-level space policy and space posture reviews in progress. There's a congressionally ordered national space posture review, and then the White House ordered a national space posture review. And they have different teams of people working on those, and those results will probably be trailing in here later in the next couple of months towards the end of the year. And so I would look for the roll-up from the Augustine report to be tempered and integrated with the recommendations that come out of these two larger national space posture reviews. So, we can get excited or not about the recommendations in the Augustine report, but the fat lady hasn't sung yet, and we're not going to know. I don't think we're going to really know until the president's budget drops in February what really is going to be the focus and the support behind things, because it's all well and good to say you're in favor of space, but if the budgets don't show up, then what good does that do you? I think we are getting a lot of positive signals out of the White House. Certainly, the most encouraging thing to me about the Augustine report was that they did make their top recommendation, something that we voiced a very strong opinion with them about, that we've been talking about, as you know, for years, and that is that NASA simply needs more money. You can't expect a space agency to operate with a budget that's been in constant decline in real dollars for 22 years and expect to get the kind of space program you want. And the Norman and his folks did tackle that one head on and say, look, you know, we were supposed to look at how to do this within the budget, but, you know, we got to get real. Either you give NASA more money or you're not going to have the space program you want.
Well, Ellie, let me ask you this. You know, as the space community has been debating all of this along with the Augustine panel and trying to make contributions, the thing that has struck me in the last year or so, more than in any other time in my career, is that if you gave the space community exactly what it wanted, in fact, gave it more, give us 1% of the federal budget, give us $5 or $6 billion more a year, I don't think sometimes this space community could figure out how to agree to go to do something with it. Back to the moon, out of Mars, direct to Mars, to the asteroids, low Earth orbit first, Ares rocket, direct rocket, Jupiter rocket, EELV. Herding cats, you know.
I think there's a couple of dynamics at play there, and the first one I'm gonna mention is, I think, a real positive thing, and that is that there are a lot of people who are very, very passionate about the nation's space program, and so you do have people who are passionately committed to, let's get to Mars. So you have people that are just as passionate about let's go to the moon or let's go to Lagrangian points or, you know, whatever they're passionately committed to doing. And I think that's really great news. It's healthy conversation to have. But at the end of the day, you've got to have a space program, at least, you know, your national civil space program that has clear goals and objectives and an executable budget. I think the other part where we get a lot of chatter is a real normal business competition in the industry. We have some tremendous companies. I mean, you know, your sponsors, United Launch Alliance, and just name all the companies down there in Florida. These are really capable, talented people. They believe in what they're doing. They want to make a contribution, and they're also, you know, they're good business people, and they want a solution that's going to favor their company. At the end of the day, it's going to, you know, be for the national policymakers and the president ultimately to decide what NASA is going to do, and then NASA will turn around and say, okay, here's what we've got to do, how are we going to do that, and look for people to bring proposals. I think, you know, there's always nervousness as long as there's a perception in industry that there are going to be winners and losers. Once the competition shakes out and everybody knows what their job is, this industry can get focused and deliver on its commitments like no other.
And just to be clear, the Space Foundation, you've always supported space at a very high level, but you're not going to get into the game of picking rockets or destinations.
No, we never do. I mean, we have customers on all sides of the equation, and really our job is to argue at the very highest level, you know, space is good, the United States should be as strong as possible in space, and whether it's civil, commercial, national security space. You know, we need a good NASA program. We need a strong national security program. We need a very good commercial set of policies to enable that industry. And frankly, you know, I think that's one area that doesn't get enough attention because, as I say, it's on a global basis, 70% of the revenues are generated out of the commercial space sector. And it's an incredibly hamstrung sector in terms of international regulation and U.S. export controls. So, you know, we look at it all, but we don't get into, it ought to be this rocket or that rocket. That's what the technical experts are for, and we're really policy and education experts.
Yeah, and speaking of policy and education, let's talk about your trip to China. You mentioned the United States maintaining its leadership role and whatnot. We've used buzzwords like another space race with the Chinese. We've heard Washington cares, they don't care. What you went over, tell us what you did and what did you see and what do you think?
Well, we've been working on our long-term relationship with the Chinese space community for about 10 years. And you'll recall when you were working with us, we've had a number of delegations of Chinese that we had brought over to visit.
Great people.
And fantastic people. And this last spring at the National Space Symposium, we presented our Space Achievement Award to the China Manned Space Engineering Organization for the Shenzhou 7 flight, which is only their third manned flight and just a list of accomplishments as long as you're on. And that was really the beginning of a whole new level of intensity with the relationship. We were invited over. We've been asked to become the bridge to the U.S. space industry and to NASA. And so we took a delegation, mostly Space Foundation. We did bring Fred Gregory and Tom Hendricks, both former astronauts, as you know.
Good guys.
Real good guys. And we had an incredible, incredible experience in China, just really an experience of a lifetime. I got to tell you, they threw the doors wide open to us. The level of dialogue, they held nothing back. Any question, I'll give you an example. I was trying to get an answer to a simple question. I was pointing at something, and I wanted to know, was that a solid rocket booster or a liquid fuel booster? And so I asked the guy about the fuel, and he started to give me the chemical formula, the molecular formula for the fuel they were using. We had access there that I've never had at a trip to Kennedy Space Center. You and I have been up the launch towers and things, but they don't let you climb on the orbiters and poke your head into something and processing and climb up on the launch plat.
Never touch the flight hardware.
Never touch it. We could touch anything, ask anything, go anywhere. It was absolutely phenomenal. So we started out in Beijing. We saw all the facilities there in Space City, both the manufacturing side as well as the astronaut training center, which is a fascinating place, and the Beijing Aerospace Control Center, essentially mission control, mission operations. Everywhere we go, we were extremely well received. And the thing that struck me was not just that our hosts were so cordial, because a lot of them we had met and developed relationships over the years, and I call these people my friends. But the Chinese people, we spent a lot of time. They gave us plenty of time on our own, and we could go where we wanted to go. And these people like Americans. I'm sure there are those who don't. But everybody that we met, it was like, whoa, American, can we talk? Hey, come on in. Can we, what can we do? We love Americans. And I think the most important thing about this trip is it's a real important step in building some engagement. You're much less likely to have problems among nations if they're engaged with each other, if they understand each other. We all have our counterparts.
Yeah.
So I think that was the most important thing to come out of the trip.
Let me want to ask you one more thing about it. We're going to take a 2-minute break. We're going to finish our talk about China and one other topic. We'll be back after a couple of minutes break here on Space Talk WMMB.
If it's happening in space, Jim Behnke is there. Okay, well, not in space, but he's all about it. This is Space Talk on WMMB.
And our final segment on Space Talk today on an October 17th, 2009 edition. We're joined today by Elliot Pullum, president of the Space Foundation in Colorado Springs. We've been talking about his recent visit to China and seeing all things space over there. And Elliot, just a kind of a wrap-up question on China. I mean, really two parts. One, did you get the sense that they're doing their work there on their own. It's their own work, as it were, or are they copying more of what they're seeing around them?
You know, they were extremely upfront with us on those issues. As you know, we had an editor from Aviation Week, Frank Mooring, with us, and he asked a lot of very difficult questions. And they were very happy to say, you know, we're in this range here. We knew we needed to test satellites. We knew that the Europeans had that technology. We hired them. This is what something that we developed ourselves. That is not. And you know, what I would say is that they're very good, and they are the first to acknowledge that they are significantly behind us. So, you know, I don't think that people that are, you know, worried about some kind of a screaming, oh, my gosh, space race,
yeah,
you know, should worry about it so much. But what they do have that we do, that we sometimes really would like to see for ourselves is they have a very clear sense of national commitment, a very clear and unwavering political commitment, and they have a clear and well-maintained source of funding for what they're doing. And I'll just say that the facilities that we saw, obviously, you know, decades younger than our facilities, absolutely first-class facilities and engineering going on everywhere.
Don't get too worried about their vehicle. Assembly building looks a lot like ours.
No, and, you know, they really look at the U.S. space program with a tremendous amount of respect and admiration, and would like to work with us as friends, and probably Space Station is the first place to do that. We mm-hmm. were able to inspect a vehicle that they call a Target Vehicle 1, which is going to be part of their next Shenzhou mission, which will be a docking mission. And it looks like about a three-quarter scale space station module.
Yeah.
And it's got a docking ring on the end. And, you know, we were asking them about, you know, does this fit with the Russian androgynous? Oh, no, it's a totally different system we designed ourselves. Well, would it work on station? No, but we could take it off and put an adapter on there. And, you know, mm-hmm. we'd love to see about doing that.
You know, the idea that they're pumping out so many engineers, that their education yes. system is so geared toward them. I mean, we don't have that. The number of them, and of course, their sheer numbers are just incredible on anything in China, but they really are turning out the people they need to go do this.
Yeah, they really are. It's a tremendous intellectual capital that they have. You know, when we were visiting the facilities in Space City, there were the government facilities. There were also the non-government facilities. Our primary organization for doing a lot of the contracting for them is called CAST, which is the China Academy of Space Technology. Mm-hmm. That single organization has 130,000 people working for it, almost wow. 10 times as many as NASA.
Wow, that's incredible. So don't be worried about them racing us to the moon or planting a red flag on the moon ahead of us?
No, they really want to do things in collaboration and, frankly, don't understand, you know, why we have issues working with them. I would say this, though, that they are very purposeful, and if we don't become purposeful, if we continue to delay programs, to live with gaps in our programs and so forth, we will find ourselves behind at some point. We're certainly not there, and we're not in any imminent danger of being there, but these guys you know, have a purpose, and it's amazing because it's sort of a part of a larger thing that I observed, which is this incredible national sense of prosperity. Walking around Beijing is just the most fascinating thing, and even out in Jiayuguan and Jiquan and some of the smaller places that we went, there's just this incredible air of prosperity, you know, beautiful new buildings, everybody's busy, and I think that sort of economic engine behind their space program is probably something that we ought to be concerned about and take a good hard look at ourselves.
Well, and I got to ask the political question, Elliot. I mean, you know, their form of government versus the world versus ours. How does this nation, how does the United States reconcile their political history, their government history, and the differences that we can find the common ground?
Well, you know, I think it's hard for us because we are very quick to find faults in others and not so quick to find fault in ourselves. Chinese are not perfect, obviously. There are issues, Tibet, and so on, but you know, if you look at their history and ask yourself which country has been invading other countries over the past 20 years, it's not China; it's the United States, and they are a very they're a country that has a multi-thousand year history of defending against invaders, and that's really their mindset. They're not expeditionary. They're really concerned about protecting their homeland. And so, I think we have to be honest about what we're doing as well as be honest about what they're doing. We have to recognize that although their form of government obviously would not work for us, a lot of people I talk to, I got to tell you, they think it's not perfect either, and it's remarkable how free they feel to criticize their government, but they also say that for China, it is the right form of government for them. And so, we need to think deeply on things before we just fire and forget.
Okay, so now let's move on to a new topic, and let's swing the pendulum all the other way. Go to the other side of your brain, and let's talk about it. Let's hear it from you, the big space cadet. What did you think of the last Star Trek movie?
I thought that it was definitely the best Star Trek movie of all the movies. I was amazed at the way they were able to, both be faithful to the characters in the original series, the original crew, but also give those characters currency and new dimension and passion, and to stay loyal to the canon while still opening up a whole new world of experiences and possibilities for this new crew. I thought the acting was phenomenal. It's clearly the best Star Trek acting we've ever seen in a Star Trek movie, and the production and direction was just through the roof.
And
amazing.
And real quick, Elliot, a chance to inspire a new generation. Two of my three boys have found the Star Trek all on their own. Chance to get new kids excited about space flight and go on and do some neat things.
Absolutely, absolutely. People forget that dynamic, when you talk to our people in our industry, what was it that got you interested in getting involved in the space program or in the space industry? The two answers you get are watching the Apollo program or watching Star Trek.
That's great.
A surprising amount of people that will tell you it was watching Star Trek.
That's right. Elliot, thanks so much for being with me today. We're going to wrap up here and say goodbye to you, but my best to everyone. Tell Sadie she still got it.
Thank you, Jim. Great talking to you again. Hope to see you soon.
You bet. Thanks, Elliot. Well, there he goes, Elliot Pullen, president of the Space Foundation. We've only got about a minute left here and just enough time for me to tell you that next week we're going to focus on the 40th anniversary of the Apollo 12 mission, that flight anniversary in November. We're going to focus on it next week. We're going to have Apollo 12 moonwalker Alan Bean with us on the phone, and as well as Nancy Conrad, the wife of the late Pete Conrad, who was the commander of Apollo 12. It should be an outstanding program next week. That's it for this week's Space Talk, brought to you by United Space Alliance. And, I made it the whole hour without talking about the Vikings playing the Ravens this weekend and saying to you that I am nervous about the game. Well, at least I almost made it. Well, have a great week, everyone. I am Jim Behnke, and you are listening to WMMB.